AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Hello and welcome. It's our bonus Q&A episode of Books of the Year. We're here in the studio with best-selling international superstar Anne Cleeves. Is that fair enough as a description?
OBE? I find that slightly disconcerting, but I still feel like an imposter. You know, 20 years of not being really selling very much at all. And then suddenly, here I am.
Does that give you, this is one of the questions of the Q&A, but it just occurred to me because you mentioned that fact in our other conversation. Yeah. Does that give you a drive to carry on and keep going because you've still got so many stories in you?
What it gives me is no pressure at all, because for all that time I was writing for the joy of it. And I, not because I was making any money. It wasn't work. It was complete escape and pleasure. And it still is.
Fantastic. Okay. And you've given a lot of encouragement to people who maybe are writing and thinking, will I ever get there?
Yeah, I'm hoping there are lots of, you know, they call them mid-list authors with a bit of a sneer. I was a mid-list author or below mid-list for all that time. It's luck. You know, there are lots and lots of brilliant writers who are stuck at the bottom of the heap. And sometimes it is just a bit of luck that gets you recognised.
What was the luck that you got?
The luck for me was writing the first Shetland book. It was, I suppose, Scandi Noir was around at that time. Reviewers picked it up because it was as close to Scandi as you can get. And suddenly I was being reviewed in the national press for the first time. It won the Gold Dagger, which is quite a big deal. And I was suddenly started to sell in translation and overseas.
Cool. Okay, I was getting distracted there. So here's the first official question. What is the last book, Anne, that you really, really enjoyed reading?
This is really tricky because I read so much. I think probably Clown Town by Mick Herron, because it's so prescient. He wrote it before the election.
Wow.
And it's, yeah, you know, he's just got what's happened in British politics, I think.
So Clown Town.
Clown Town.
So can you...
It's the latest of the Jackson Lamb stories.
Oh, okay.
So it brings us up to date, and it's funny and it's satirical and it's vicious about British politics and power hungry people, and I loved it.
And do you picture Gary Oldman?
I've never seen the show because I love the book so much that I've not watched the show. I will have to watch it, but yeah, I'll maybe wait until Mick has finished writing all
that's
the books.
That's a purist.
No, I have the pictures in my head.
Okay, well, our next question is about screen adaptations. Obviously, you've not seen Slow Horses, but what is your favourite screen adaptation of a novel that's, modesty insists, is not one
no,
of your own?
No, obviously not. Going back to Sarah Waters, do you remember Sarah Waters who did Fingersmith and Tipping the Velvet? Loved her books, yeah. and thought they were so well done, those TV adaptations. So that's a long time ago. It's going back probably to the end of the last century, isn't it?
Yeah, Tipping the Velvet was.
Yeah.
And obviously it's fantastic if you get an adaptation because a whole new audience get to witness and experience your books. Is it an uneasy experience from an author's point of view? Because the TV show has to tell people, this person looks like this, this is what happens, and they picture it in a different way.
I think most people can separate the book, because with the book, I'm inside people's heads looking out. I don't really describe my characters at all, if you've noticed, when I'm writing, you don't, because I'm in their heads looking out. And if you're doing television, it's all from outside. And you're dependent on great actors to show the things that I'm telling. And it's just a very different process. I was very happy to hand it over once I trusted the team, and it's the same production company, Silverprint, that makes Vera Shetland and made The Long Call. So just, I watch it like everyone else. I watch Shetland on Wednesday night, you know, with a cup of tea and thought, oh, I thought I knew. Yeah. I knew. But I'd never seen the script and it's not an adaptation anymore. So.
What is the worst thing that's happened to you whilst in the middle of writing a book?
Oh, goodness. I suppose that would be Tim dying, because then you're just completely thrown off. And I wasn't sure I'd be able to carry on writing at that point. But in the end, writing, like reading, is an escape, because it takes you into a different world and you're with different people. And in a way, that's what helps you carry on. I do work quite a lot with libraries and with a project called Reading for Wellbeing. And we work a lot around how reading can, you know, if you've got chronic pain or you've got mild mental illness, anxiety, stress, and you've got these weird ideas rattling around in your head, sometimes being inside other people's heads for a bit is really great. And so I think that's what saw me through.
Do you find it all, when it's flowing, is it all consuming, or are you able to go, no, I'm just going to do a couple of hours and then I'm going to do something?
Yeah, I've got into a sort of rhythm with it. I get up very early. It was no hardship getting up at 5 o'clock this morning, get the train down from Newcastle, because that's generally when I wake up. And I'll have a cup of tea and listen to the news for a bit. And then I start writing about 5 to 6 o'clock, because that's when I do it best. So I'm finished at lunchtime. That's fine. Go for a walk. See friends.
Lovely. Can you write anywhere, or do you have a routine? Do you have a special place where you need to write?
I don't need to write, but if I'm starting a book, it's always at my kitchen table. Sit at my kitchen table with a laptop, and that's...
And what is it about the kitchen table?
It's the warmest room in the house. So this time of year, on the northeast coast, that's important.
Is it when you're sat at that kitchen table, are you looking at the wall? Are you looking out the window?
No, I'm looking at the wall, and I'm wherever I'm writing. So it can be blowing a hoolie outside, but if I'm writing a Matthew Venn book in North Devon and it's midsummer, then in my head it's midsummer. Yeah.
So you're sitting there with snacks, cup of tea?
Tea, I drink lots of tea.
Anything else you need? Music?
No. Quiet, definite quiet.
Can you write with music or not?
No, need quiet. But once I'm into a book, I can write in on trains and in airports and things.
So once you're going...
I can do it.
So we're quite likely to see you tapping on a laptop literally anywhere.
Yeah.
On the train going back today?
No, but I'm working out a plot point in my head, so I'll just be thinking about a book, not writing.
Can we help in any way?
No, I'm not going to tell you about that.
Who's involved? What's the scene? If you hadn't become a hugely successful writer, which you are now, and as you said earlier, you weren't to start with, is there another job that would have appealed that you could imagine that you'd have done?
Well, I trained as a social worker, and that isn't about trying to save the world. It's just that I'm incredibly nosy about people and what makes them tick. So I might have carried on doing that, though I suspect I would find it a bit stressful. Otherwise, I worked in public libraries working in reader development. So looking at ways of bringing more people in, making sure that libraries were there for everybody and people were welcome there, setting up reading groups, promoting, running author events, which was very frustrating because they were never mine. They were always big name authors. So
You just reminded me, Anne, and Matt, you'll remember this. In a previous incarnation of the radio that we did, there was a fantastic rivalry between Shetland Library and Orkney Library.
Oh, of course. There still is.
They used to message saying, you know, we're still open, they're closed. I think it was Orkney that stayed open for longer, but I can't remember. But they would send us messages saying how great they are and how much better they are.
Well, the friend that I stayed with in Orkney to do the research for the Killing Stones was called Stuart Bain, and he was the assistant librarian in Orkney Libraries who set up that Twitter feud, and now there's still that rivalry. He's not working for them, he works for Radio Orkney now, but when they Shetland Libraries knew that The Killing Stones was going to be set in Orkney. There was this image all over social media of Stuart, but with a traitor's hood on.
I love the fact that these two libraries, who aren't really that close because you described their geography earlier, have this fierce rivalry.
Oh, it's great fun. They get on very well.
Excellent. Is there a piece of advice that perhaps you got sort of early on in your career that you wish you'd listened to?
No, I don't think so. And even when I was a kid, my parents were very good about not putting pressure on us. So my dad always said, don't care what you do as long as you're happy. If you're working on the bins, that's fine, as long as it's what you want to do. And I think I've always been lucky and had that sort of support. And no, nobody bothered giving me career advice when I started writing, because they all knew that I would just sort of plodder on the bottom of the heap and would make them no money. And
how wrong they were.
Yeah, there you go.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
It's headphone time, and if you put those headphones on, we try to surprise our guests with a question from a fellow author and fan. Here is a voice note from broadcaster and crime author Steph McGovern.
Hey Simon, hiya Matt, and hello Anne as well. Now, as you know, I'm a massive fan of your books. I love The Killing Stones. I love everything you do. But what I want to know, right, is do you ever get your worlds confused? Like if you're in the middle of writing a Vera book, do you ever accidentally get like Jimmy Perez walking in or anything like that? Like, how do you keep those two worlds apart? I'd love to know. See ya.
Hi, Steph. No, I don't get them confused because I am so in that world when I'm writing it. They're completely different. No, don't get confused at all.
Would your characters like each other?
I'm not sure that they would, really. I'm just trying to think. People always said, oh, can you not write a book with Jimmy and Vera working on the same case? And I always say, well, maybe for a comic relief sketch, but otherwise I can't see it.
That feels like a no. Right. Okay, so short chapters versus long chapters.
Both, depends how it's going. So I might write a long chapter and then do a couple of very short ones, but I'm not really thinking of it in those terms. I'm not a writer who analyses her work at all. I will write it when I've come to the end of what I want to say in that chapter. I'll stop and do another one.
But what about when you're reading? Do you enjoy that sort of, wow, I've just ticked off an entire chapter and it only took me 30 seconds kind of feeling? Because I know I do.
Yeah, I quite like that. I do quite like short chapters, but I do like a variety too. So I would get a bit frustrated if all I got were 30-second chapters. Yeah. Sometimes you just want to get in and dig into a story.
How do you order your bookshelves at home? If we were to wander around your house with you, is it sort of shambolic? Is it beautifully
total
arranged?
Total chaos. Oh, okay. Absolutely total chaos.
So you don't arrange them?
I don't arrange them. There are piles everywhere. There are shelves in the kitchen. There are shelves in the living room. There are piles by my bed. Because I get sent lots of proofs as well to endorse or to, in the hope that I'll blurb them. And I don't want to throw them away, but you can't actually do anything with them because you're not a charity shops can't even sell them. So I give them to friends, or I will just stick them eventually when they're piling up to the ceiling, stick them in the recycling.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that, again, that's a very reassuring answer, to be perfectly honest, because we've had people, was it John Boyne who arranged his books by region, so that American authors were all together, European authors were all together, Irish authors had a particular section, and then like the rest of the world, like going into a wine shop, you know, it was arranged like that. So that's never.
No, that's not me, because life's too short, isn't it? I mean, it might be quite nice because then I'd be able to find a book that I'm looking for.
I was going to say, but if we were to come to your house and I say, "Oh, can you find me this book that I know you've got?" You would have no clue.
I would struggle. Yeah.
Wow. How are you with deadlines? How do you do you stick to them?
I do. I'm very good with deadlines. I know that I can easily do a book a year. I would never agree to do more than that. I've never missed a deadline in any circumstance.
Wow, yet. Never?
No, I'm wow. always early for everything. I mean, I was at King's Cross early today to meet my publicist, Emma. I'm always early.
You're a gift.
No, it's a curse in a way, because I spend a lot of time hanging around airports and train stations.
Yeah, but you're not late.
Yeah.
No, I am never late.
That's very, very admirable. I remember speaking to an American author once who regulated his year, like his calendar, around the writing. So he too did one a year, but would start on like January the 7th and would always be finished by July the 20th, and then he'd go on holiday. Are you that rigorous?
No, I'm not. I'm supposed to deliver, I think, in August, but I always deliver before that, which allows plenty of time. I need editing. I think we all have to be open to editing. So it'll go to my agent first. My US and my UK agent work together, and they'll send me notes. And then I'm lucky because both my US and UK publisher, they're both Macmillan. So then I get joint notes back from the editors too. And sometimes I don't agree, but usually they're right, because you're so close to a book when you're writing it that there are things that you see very clearly but forget to tell the reader, or things that you passionately want to put in. And it just slows things down, or bits of research that you think are important and that isn't needed.
Can you give us an example with this book of a note that you did that you thought, yes, that's...
I'm trying to think. It's hard to say without giving away the plot. So I can't.
Okay, that's absolutely
fine.
No,
I can't. Yeah. No. I'll tell you when we're off air.
Read the book, buy the book, then we can share. Final question, Anne. You are throwing a fantasy dinner party and you can invite three authors, living or dead. Who's coming?
I think I would need three very different people. I'm fascinated by Dorothy L. Sayers, who comes across as being quite straight. She was very religious, and yet she had a child out of wedlock that ended up being adopted and she lost contact with. She was, if you read about her, she was one of those spare women, the women after the First World War, who there were so many women left compared with men. She was obviously really just desperate for love and was horribly used by various men, I think. And so her Lord Peter Wimsey is like her fantasy man. And it would be really quite interesting to talk to her. And if you're interested in that sort of period, read Emma Flint's Other Women, which is stunning. It's a really, really brilliant novel. And then my hero, I suppose, one of my... because I'm going for writers. Sarah Paretsky, who's American, based in Chicago, who was probably the first real feminist crime writer and is still going, still writing great books. I would have her because she's just fun but intelligent, so sparky and so bright. She wrote the V.I. Warshawski books. And then... just for some light relief, because I've never met her, but she is just comes across as wise and witty and funny. I'd have Marion Keyes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
We've had her on the show. Yeah.
We have.
Yeah. So I think she'd be brilliant. So those three. So Dorothy, because I'm just very curious about, and I hope we would, you know, give her a lovely time and lighten her up a bit, so she wouldn't feel the need to be translating Dante or whatever she did in her spare time.
We've all done that.
Yes.
The interesting thing, that's very interesting, asking for Marion Keyes, because you do need, whatever combination of people, you need someone like that who can get on with everybody and can just combine it all together.
I don't know if she still does it, but she did a Radio 4 programme where people would sort of just send in their queries, like an agony aunt, and she was so funny and so wise on that. I loved hearing it.
And it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you very much indeed. The Killing Stones is published by Macmillan, is out now. Get it before Christmas. Gift it. Listen to the audiobook. I'm doing a good sell on this.
You're being brilliant. Thank you very much.
And if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com or via our socials. We're going to take a Christmas break now, but we'll be back in mid-January firing on all cylinders with some great new books to share with you. Until then, have a wonderful festive break and we'll see you in 2026.